Good evening and welcome. I'm Kelly Richards, CEO of the All Access Group and the host of All Access Radio. As a highly sought-after consultant, super connector, trusted advisor, celebrity wrangler, and thought leader, I connect innovators and influencers from Silicon Valley to Hollywood to Madison Avenue. As a trusted advisor, I transform the quality of people's lives. I'm also the author of the best-selling ebook, The Magic and Moxie of Apple, An Insider's View. Tonight's guest on the show is Alan Weiss. Alan is a leading consultant, speaker, and author. His consulting firm, Summit Consulting Group, has attracted clients including Merck, Hewlett-Packard, GE, Mercedes-Benz, Times Mirror Group, the Federal Reserve, New York Times, Toyota, and over 500 other leading organizations. His prolific publishing empire includes over 500 articles and 55 books, including his bestseller, Million Dollar Consulting, and his latest Million Dollar Launch. His books have been on the curricula at Villanova, Temple University, and the Wharton School of Business, and have been translated into 12 languages. The New York Post called him one of the most highly regarded independent consultants in America, and certainly he's one of the most sought after and in demand. And Alan also hosts an annual thought leadership conference, which draws world-famous experts as speakers. He's also one of my personal mentors. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Thanks, Kelly. Good to be here.
Great to have you. You know, Alan, having a trusted advisor is so important. You are one of mine, as you know Steve Jobs was when he was alive. Who have been some of your mentors along the way, and how have they impacted and influenced you over time?
Well, I think as I look back on it, probably my most important mentor is my wife. I've been married 46 years. We were high school sweethearts, and, you know, she's seen my act 450,000 times. So she has a great perspective on what I'm doing and whether it makes sense and what needs to be tweaked or abandoned or created. When she's in the audience sometimes and I see her laughing, I know I'm really good because I know she's heard the story 100 times before.
Yeah,
so I think she's been the most important mentor in my career.
And I love the fact that you guys, I love your approach together because I know that you eat out every night of the week and that's when you take the time to really mull through what's going on. And I just love that approach.
Yeah, it works out well. And if you watch your waistline, you're okay.
Exactly. Well, Alan, you started consulting over 30 years ago. And as we've seen in the tech and media spaces, a lot can happen in three decades and change is the only constant. So what have you seen change in the field of consulting over this time, and which things have stayed fundamentally the same?
What stayed fundamentally the same is what I call the evergreen stuff, and that is strategy, leadership, communication, employee commitment. You know, I could go on and on, but there are two dozen things that have been important for organizations since the Industrial Revolution. Those things haven't changed, but what has changed mightily are things like time. For example, companies used to spend 2 months setting strategy that's supposed to be good for 5 years. And
right.
What I advise companies today is they should be setting strategy in about 6 days and expect it to be good for 12 to 18 months at the most. Other things that have changed include demographics. The world is different. You know, the United States will have a non-white majority in the next 10, 15 years. Economics have changed. Volatility has become the norm. Globalization has changed. And, you know, if you look at China and India and Indonesia and Africa, you're talking something like 5 billion people who are growing consumers, growing middle class, which will have a tremendous influence on business. And then finally, if you look at social mores, you'll find tremendous change that applies to consulting and consulting clients. For example, 10, 15 years ago, everyone expected the right of privacy. Today, anyone who expects the right of privacy is delusional because almost everything you say and utter can be broadcast with or without your consent. So it's a different world in a lot of respects.
Yeah. And I think to your point about the global shifts that have happened, one of the things you espouse to those of us that work closely with you is the importance of us having a global mindset and working globally.
Correct.
Agreed on all of that. Now, you've said that the greatest obstacle to achieving huge success in business and in life is not lack of information, resources, or capacity, but rather a lack of self-worth. Could you elaborate a bit on that?
Now, when I started in this business, working with Fortune 500 companies, and then migrated over really to helping other consultants and coaches and so forth, what I found both among executives and among consultants was a tremendous lack of self-worth. They felt like imposters. They didn't believe in themselves. And so wherein I thought originally it was capitalization that was the key issue, it's not. It's how people look at themselves. And the trouble is that people carry around baggage that's no longer appropriate, something their parents told them 30 years ago, or they allow others to establish who they are. Some other people press their buttons. And so they don't have the wherewithal, the emotional wherewithal, to grow into their own person. And that's what I help most people with today.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly have helped, I will admit myself, at times in some of those areas, with some of your materials as well as your direct advice. Now, in your book Thrive, arguably one of my favorites, Alan, you talk about applying the five factors that help somebody master their fate. What are those quickly, and can you give us an example of how you've applied those to your own life?
Well, one factor is understanding that you need to be comfortable in your own skin. You can't subscribe to what somebody else says you should be. You have to be your own person, and you have to. And so the example is trying to change constantly to please others makes you into a non-entity. The second is you need a huge vocabulary. You need to be able to use words as tools. Those are our toolkit, and you need to be able to find nuance and use metaphor and example. And the example is that when you're dealing with a client, when you're dealing with a prospect, your ability to create a metaphor has very high impact, and it saves you a lot of talk, a lot
mm-hmm.
of words. The third thing is that you need a sense of humor. You need to be able to put things in perspective, and humor does that. It alleviates stress. Stress causes you to tighten up. It impedes your physical movement. It constricts your throat, and it helps put a client at ease as well. So you need the perspective that I think originates in humor. The fourth is that you need to know history and geography. And while that might sound like a grammar school endeavor, I find that a lot of people have no idea where they are or why they're here.
Right.
History and geography are being are receiving short shrift in schools today. They're lightening up on their attention, and people have no feeling. They can't tell you whether the Civil War was before or after the First World War. They can't tell you where Botswana is located. And these are significant drawbacks. And the fifth factor is that you have to be light on your feet. You have to be innovative. You can't simply solve problems. Solving problems has become a commodity. People are pretty good at solving problems today, believe it or not. What they're not good at is creating a new future. What they're not as adept at is setting a new level, raising the bar. And that's highly valued today, and that's what I think everybody needs to be looking at.
I would love to see you focus a future book title on that last topic.
Thank you.
Alan, what's the myth of humility?
The myth of humility is that people go around saying that it's important to be humble. And I have never met a thought leader. I have never met a successful business executive, a successful athlete, a successful actor, or someone in entertainment who's humble. Humility is appropriate in certain places. You should be humble when you're in church. You should be humble when you're dealing with your family. But you should never be humble, for example, as a consultant, in dealing with a client or a prospect. They expect you to be the expert. And experts don't say, well, what would you like to do? Or which of these options should you take? Experts say, here's what you should do. And so being humble is a cop-out by people who don't have the self-worth to be aggressive and assertive and strong so that people feel a sense of confidence in them. So that's what I call the myth of humility.
Yeah, I love that. Let's talk about influence. Is it learned, or are some people just naturally more influential than others? In your opinion,
both.
What are some small things that listeners can do to start developing their influence?
It's both. Some people are naturally influential, and others can learn it. It's a learnable skill. The best book on the subject is Influence by Robert Cialdini, and he's going to be my guest at my Thought Leadership Conference, which you mentioned, this October.
Right.
I think what people can do to master influence is learn four or five basic steps which will help them be more influential. For example, if you want to be influential, create scarcity. And that means that people feel that there's a limited amount of time available to them to take advantage of something. If you want to be influential, don't do public polling, do secret polling. And that means that if you've got a group of executives in front of you, or for that matter, members of a school board or members of the Little League Board of Trustees, doesn't matter, don't ask them out loud to state what their preference is on a controversial issue. Have them write it down and submit it, just like a jury foreman does, and says, who's for guilt and who's for acquittal? And you write it down and you say, well, it's 7-4 and 5 against. But if you make people commit publicly, if they state where they are, it's harder to get them to change their minds. So there are numerous techniques like those that can be used to gain influence.
Now, there are some who might say, Alan, that this kind of thinking borders on, dare I say it, manipulation. What would you say to those folks?
Well, those people ought to practice being humble because they just don't get it. Manipulation, see, depends on your motive. Every day, and Dan Pink wrote a book called To Sell is Human, and he
right.
was a guest at my Thought Leadership Conference 2 years ago.
Recall.
Everybody tries to influence every day. If your goal is to somehow get something for nothing, to cheat people, then it's manipulative. That's what I call multi-level marketing, which
mm-hmm.
never, ever works out for people who get in after the initial couple.
Mm-hmm.
But if your goal is to help people, so you've got to understand that when you're selling something, you're really providing value. And if you provide value and you get compensated for that, that's capitalism. That's an equitable transaction. So as long as you're providing value, sales is a noble thing. And therefore, trying to influence people to accept value is not at all manipulative. It's quite proper.
Mm-hmm. From the perspective of serving them.
That's right.
And
providing
them
with an improved future.
Indeed, indeed. Now, you espouse often to those of us in your community that investing in yourself is in your own professional growth is critical. What about those who might object that investing in yourself is selfish? Is there a healthy selfishness in your opinion?
Yeah, healthy selfishness is investing in yourself. You
yeah.
should always pay yourself first. You know, on an airplane, they say, put your own oxygen mask on first before you help others, because you can't help others unless you help yourself. Anybody
right.
who feels that investing in themselves is selfish is just a fool.
Yeah. Yeah. And why is it so important to continue to invest in yourself and your growth?
Because you can't grow without finding key vehicles to help you grow. And as a matter of fact, the more successful you are and the more sophisticated you get, the more you need help that requires an investment. For example, star athletes don't just say, hey, I'm on top of the pack, I'm going to stay this way. They hire very expensive, very adept coaches. And so champion golfers have swing coaches or putting coaches. Star athletes have coaches that are hired by the team. Business executives, the higher level of business executive, the more they will invest in getting a kind of sophisticated coach. Marshall Goldsmith, who spoke at my first Thought Leadership Conference, charges $200,000 to coach an executive. And his schedule is filled because he's the best there is, and people need that kind of help.
Yeah, yeah. Now, tell us about your most recent book, Alan, Million Dollar Launch. What can readers expect from this particular title, and how does it differ from some of the other things you might have touched on in this topic previously?
Well, I was talking to somebody in my coaching program who's in the search business, and he said to me, you know, the first 90 days are critical with a new employee. And I said, God, there's something about that that really, really resonates with me. So I wrote to McGraw-Hill, who's been one of my two major publishers over the years, and I said to the editor, what about a book called The First 90 Days, and I sent 10 lines, just 10 chapter titles. That's it, no proposal.
Yep.
The editor said, I love the book, but we want to stay with your million-dollar franchise, so we're going to call it Million Dollar Launch. Write the book, and we did a deal. And it's about how you can go for a second career if you're fired, if you retire, if you decide you're bored, whatever it is, you can launch a second career in consulting and professional services and begin to make money within 90 days.
Right. Fantastic. I love the book myself. I've read it already. And Alan, this brings me up to another very critical point that I forever marvel at in your presence, which is, how do you explain your amazing prowess and skill in coming up with book titles and chapter titles on the fly for people with such precision, clarity, and impact? Something
I
love.
Because I don't self-censor. I don't say to myself, is this good enough? I don't say to myself, could it be better? Too many people are looking for perfection, and perfection kills excellence. And so if you stop looking for perfection and you just say, let me come up with something here that's good, and then move on, you got a lot of things done in life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're particularly adept at that, and I would love to emulate that. I think your advice is probably get out of your own way, is what I'm hearing.
Well, sure, you've got the experience to do it. I mean, you said in the introduction, these are the kinds of things you do.
Yeah.
And so just keep doing it.
Yeah, exactly. And Alan, why is it important for boutique consultants in particular to create a body of work, a suite of materials that constitute their intellectual property?
Well, for several reasons. One is it sets them apart from the pack. The second reason is that it provides for passive income. When you create IP that can be turned into products and sold to people who can't afford to hire you for your services, it's a nice source of passive income. Number three is that you want to institutionalize what you do. And so if you look back on great consultants and great service providers, you know, Peter Drucker and people of that ilk, you'll find that they have a body of work that's coherent and consistent and makes you realize that they not only have they given a lot of thought to what they do, but the pragmatic applicability of what they do is rather profound.
Yeah, yeah. And you're so prolific and create so much seemingly with ease on the fly on a continuous basis. Can you shed some insights on how your fluency with this? Where does that come from?
Well, I think it's being comfortable with yourself. It's the kind of factors we talked about before, not being afraid that somebody will critique you, not being afraid that it's not the absolute best that you can do. What you have to do is provide something that helps others and then move on. You know, I love it when people write to me and say, I found 7 typos in your book, as though that's a problem. I tell them, well, there's really 12 typos. Go look for the other 5. But that's like telling me that you fly in an airplane for the food, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I love it. Now, I've had the privilege of attending your thought leadership retreats a few times, so I definitely have an insider's view and am somewhat biased. But would you like to share for our listeners a bit about what it means to be a thought leader? What are the top 3 qualities that virtually all thought leaders share, for example?
Well, thought leaders provide new IP. They provide new intellectual property, new ways of looking at things that are applicable, that people can immediately use. They're not theoretical. It's not an academic or a college professor waxing eloquent. That's number one. Number two is they're cited by others, and people refer to them as the sounding board. They refer to them as the litmus test. They refer to them as people who set the standard. They're avatars, and others recognize that. I mean, you're made an expert and a thought leader by others, really. You don't just go out and proclaim it yourself. And I think the third thing is what you mentioned earlier, and that is they create a body of work. They're not a one-trick pony. You know, I'm not convinced yet that Good to Great and Jim Collins is not a one-trick pony. You know, when Deming and Duran started in quality work, they were not one-trick ponies. I mean, this was a substantial body of work that spun off a great deal, and that's why problem solving is not a premium today. It's done so well by so many people. So you create a large body of work that's not just based on a single concept.
Yeah. Yeah, wonderful. And, you know, I'm very sensitive to your time, so I want to acknowledge and thank you for joining us. But before we finish and wrap up, Alan, I like to ask most of my guests at the end of our time together what comes next for them. In your case, I'm almost afraid to ask because I know I'm going to open the floodgates. But is there one project or collaboration you've not yet started or that's in the works that you are looking forward to?
Well, my wife and I continue to travel the world. You know, we've been to Beijing and Bali and Seville recently. Next week, as a matter of fact, my inaugural Million Dollar Consulting convention is being held in Atlanta. We have just under 200 people. And at that convention, I'll launch my new subscription series, my new Access, which is the ability to access my body of work, which is hundreds and hundreds of videos and audios and print materials, thousands of hours of stuff that people can sign up for and access whenever they like. I think that's the future. I think that's what will impact those people I talked about in Indonesia and India and China and Africa. And so I'm excited about that happening.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to joining you in Atlanta, obviously. So, Alan, thank you so much for joining us on the call tonight. I also want to thank my show producers and my wonderful listeners. Everybody have a great week. And, Alan, I'll see you next week in Atlanta.
Kelly, thanks for the great questions and continued success.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.